Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Harvey Wasserman, who discusses possible worst-case scenarios which could unfold at Japan's failed Fukushima nuclear power plant complex. Psychologist Stephen Reisner, who explains why he has filed a complaint against Army Major John Liso for his role as a psychologist in participating in the torture of prisoners held at the U.S. Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. And attorney Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who criticizes President Obama for reversing his decision to try 9/11 detainees in civilian courts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Washington Post reports the U.S. State Department covertly funded Syrian opposition groups, including a London-based satellite channel, Barada TV. The funds given to opposition groups started in 2005 under the George W. Bush administration as ties with Syria were frozen, according to secret cables released by WikiLeaks. Covert aid to civil society groups continued into the Obama administration, but the aid is being reevaluated. In January, the State Department sent its first ambassador to Damascus in 6 years. A classified 2009 cable noted Syrian officials would undoubtedly view any U.S. funds to illegal political groups as tantamount to supporting regime change. An earlier cable from the Bush years noted that so far, no dissident living in Syria has accepted U.S. covert funds out of fear of arrest or execution for treason. Instead, the funds were sent to European-based opposition groups, including Barada TV, which has a small viewership in Syria, and the Movement for Justice and Development, which seeks the removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In recent weeks, massive protests against the Assad regime have spread across Syria, with over 200 protesters killed in political violence. To show his interest in reform, President Assad repealed the 48-year-old state of emergency law, which gave the police wide powers to arrest dissidents. In 1982, Assad's father, President Hafez al-Assad, brutally crushed an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood in northern Syria, killing over 10,000 people. On March 20th, Florida evangelical preacher Reverend Terry Jones carried out his promise to burn the Quran, the Muslim holy book. The U.S. media largely ignored the Quran desecration, and there were no protests or violence over the next 2 weeks. But in early April, violence engulfed Afghanistan after President Hamid Karzai called for Pastor Jones to be arrested. Protesters attacked a United Nations compound in Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan, killing 7 foreign aid workers. In the days that followed, more angry Afghan protests left over 22 people killed and dozens injured. While U.S. officials condemned the burning of the Quran, many observers in Afghanistan openly questioned why Karzai chose to inflame tensions by publicly condemning Reverend Jones. Stephen Carter, an independent analyst based in Kabul, told the Christian Science Monitor that Karzai's pattern of anti-Western statements displays a clear degree of resentment he feels. In this particular case, he could have refrained from making a statement and acted in a way that would have made this outcome less likely. WGBH, the public television station in Boston, is the hub of television programming like Frontline, Nova, and Masterpiece Theater. Yet behind the scenes, WGBH is in the midst of an ugly fight with its own workforce. Ironically, in the middle of massive protests in Wisconsin to defend the union's right for collective bargaining, WGBH decided to cut off negotiations and impose an unpopular contract on 280 members of the Association of Employees of the Educational Foundation, Communications Workers of America Local 1300. According to the magazine In These Times, the new contract guts union rights for a third of the workers at WGBH. Managers now have the right to fire on-air talent without cause and can outsource work without the union's approval. Management also has the right to assign work across different media platforms, dramatically increasing the workload of many employees. The union at WGBH is also upset that David Koch, a prime funder of the Tea Party and other right-wing causes, currently sits on the station's board of trustees. Along with his brother, Koch has given over $17 million to anti-union initiatives, plus millions more to the GOP front group Americans for Prosperity, which is defending Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker in his fight against public sector unions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
high levels of radiation at Japan's crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant complex is reported to be a major obstacle to regaining control of 4 of the 6 reactors there that lost their cooling systems to the tsunami triggered by the devastating March 11th earthquake. U.S.-made robots that recently entered 2 of the reactor buildings detected levels of radiation so high it prevented workers from being able to make critical repairs to the broken cooling systems. Although the nuclear plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has estimated that it could take 6 to 9 months to stop radiation leaks at the 4 broken reactors of Fukushima, many nuclear experts are skeptical. One major problem is the growing evidence that the reactor pressure vessel at Unit 2 may be cracked and leaking nuclear material. TEPCO has announced plans to pump tens of thousands of metric tons of highly radioactive water out of damaged reactor buildings, which were partially destroyed by hydrogen explosions in the days after the earthquake. Government and utility officials say they will store the radioactive water in waste tanks, an artificial floating island, and U.S. Navy barges. Fishermen from Japan, South Korea, and China have expressed outrage at the pumping of tens of thousands of tons of radioactive water from Fukushima into the ocean in early April. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Harvey Wasserman, senior editor at freepress.org and author of The Last Energy War and Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030. Wasserman examines the information known about Japan's nuclear disaster and reassurances from government and the nuclear industry that radiation released from Fukushima presents little or no danger to human health.
There are apparently robots that have been sent in to a couple of the reactors, and the extremely high levels of radiation in there indicate that there's no quick fix here. We know that the government, not only of the United States, but of Japan and the utility, lied to us. What makes the situation doubly disturbing is that we also know that they don't know what's going on to a full extent. They may know more than we do, but they don't know enough because this is an entirely new situation. You've had 6 reactors compromised, 4 of them clearly seriously. A number of spent fuel pools compromised, and we don't know how many and how bad the damage has been done there. Now, radiation levels, according to Kyoto News Service, radiation levels inside reactors 1 and 3 at Fukushima were very, very high. Now, also, it appears that the reactor building number 4 has been flooded, and the water is 5 meters high. And then there's 60,000 tons of contaminated water already in units 1 and 3. We don't know what that's going to mean. We do know that there's going to be high levels of radioactive water continuing to go into the ocean. They've been dumping absorbent material. I mean, basically, here we have this global high-tech nuclear power industry, and they're essentially reduced to dumping kitty litter into these flowing pools of water, which are intensely radioactive and will be in the oceans, for eons. And so, to run through it, units 1 and 2 apparently had hydrogen explosions. We don't know the status of the cores there. Because they're still super hot, they may still yet have a meltdown. It seems to be a possibility, at least 2 of the reactors, which means the fuel, the super hot fuel, could melt through the pressure vessel, could melt through the bottom of the reactor and go into the earth and eventually as a molten ball of radioactive material hit a water table and cause a steam explosion, which would throw huge quantities of radiation into the atmosphere. That's still a possibility at maybe 2, maybe more reactors at Fukushima. We also have 6 and actually 7 spent fuel pools there. At least one of them seems to have been severely compromised with fuel rods exposed to the air, which means that the zirconium cladding will catch fire or did catch fire and throw large quantities of radiation into the atmosphere. So the bottom line, the minimum, it appears, as best I can tell, and, I'm reading as much as I can, we have 2 reactors that are still seriously untamed, to put it that way, and 1 fuel pool also in serious trouble, and that's at a minimum. Either one of those reactor cores and that one spent fuel pool could cause continued huge radiation releases on a par with Chernobyl. And so, they upped the accident rating there to a 7, which is Chernobyl, But the scale doesn't go high enough. I mean, you have six reactors that were compromised.
Harvey, when it comes to the options that the Japanese government and the utility have of controlling these four out-of-control reactors, are we talking eventually of entombment, putting sand and cement over the top of these things, and what's been described as a sarcophagus that we saw similar action in Chernobyl? Or do they have the option of repairing the cooling systems and getting these things under control in a more kind of orthodox fashion?
We don't know. And it could vary from reactor to reactor. You've got six different situations. They don't know. If you have reactors that are still hot and have the potential for melting, you can't cover them in sand and concrete because they're too hot. They have to be cooled. Not until they reach a certain level of non-criticality could we do that. I mean, you know, here we are 25 years later, almost exactly, by the way, on April 26th, out of Chernobyl, and now they can put a sarcophagus. They couldn't have done that, you know, for years and years and years.
Harvey, on one hand, we hear a lot of apologists for the nuclear industry and some scientists in our media talking about how the minimal amounts of radiation that people, you know, outside the evacuation zone in Japan are subjected to are really nothing to be concerned about. And we also hear similar things being said about the amounts of radioactivity from the disaster in Japan that are being detected all across the United States. How can we sort out fact from fiction when it comes to the dangers that we all face from radiation, whether we live, you know, 200 miles away from Fukushima in Japan or whether we live here in the United States?
This is a really serious and inflammatory and complicated question. There is no safe dose of radiation. And anyone who tells you otherwise is either ill-informed or deliberately deceiving you. If it's detectable, it's dangerous. If iodine turns up in any quantity whatsoever in milk, it should not be drunk by anyone, because the iodine will cross the into the thyroid and emit beta particles, which are similar to electrons, and damage the tissues. And the only thing that we know for sure is that there has never been found and never will be found a threshold of radiation exposure which can be deemed safe. It's just not available.
That was Harvey Wasserman, senior editor at freepress.org and author of The Last Energy War and Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030. Find links to Wasserman's articles and more information on the Fukushima disaster on our website at btlonline.org. Psychologist Stephen Reisner is an outspoken critic of those in his profession who participated in coercive interrogations or torture, which he says is defined as treatment that injures a prisoner for the purpose of extracting information. Reisner maintains that torture takes many forms, but that emotional and psychological techniques, such as sleep deprivation, isolation, and humiliation, leave more serious, though invisible, scars than the physical tactics that are usually thought of as torture, such as applying electric shocks or waterboarding. In early April, he appeared in New York District Court to press his complaint against fellow psychologist Army Major John Liso, who Reisner accused of unethical conduct for his role in the torture of prisoners at the U.S. military's Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. The complaint accused Liso of recommending the interrogation methods employed against Mohammed al-Qahtani, an alleged 9/11 conspirator, that Reisner says included forced hydration, induced hypothermia, 20-hour interrogations, forced nudity, and religious disgrace. The complaint, which charges Liso of violating New York State professional standards, was supported by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Justice and Accountability. The Pentagon didn't respond to a request for comment on Reisner's complaint against Major Liso. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Stephen Reisner about torture and what he believes to be the ethical position a psychologist should hold regarding the issue.
I can tell you from having treated torture survivors that the non-physical forms of torture have a much more traumatizing and long-lasting effect than the physical forms of torture. So when you put electrodes on somebody, or you give them a bunch of little cuts, or you beat them up, it's terrible. But they don't have as hard a time being able to talk about having been tortured then when they've been humiliated or have gone crazy or have put in stress positions, which makes them feel that if only they hadn't moved in just this position, it wouldn't have hurt so much and they could have avoided talking. The psychological pressures that lead to people to break, the research shows that they have much longer-lasting scars and effects on people than the physical tortures.
Would you say that since Bradley Manning, the alleged whistleblower in the WikiLeaks case, is kept in isolation 23 hours a day, or any prisoner for that matter, is kept in isolation, that's torture?
Yep.
And the isolation alone, even if no other factors are present, has a really horrible detrimental effect for years afterward?
Not necessarily. That depends on the, you know, the character of the person. I mean, some people don't get traumatized. There are certain things that we've all decided over the centuries are wrong. And abusing prisoners as punishment or to get information from them is, you know, universally condemned, except at certain periods in time by certain regimes that until the Bush administration, our government joined in condemning.
Stephen Reisner, isn't it true that the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association prohibit their members from being involved in coercive interrogations? What's the difference between these two groups and the American Psychological Association?
The difference is that the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, follow the World Medical Association. They basically say that the role of a health practitioner is to help people and not hurt people. It's based on the, you know, the basic ethical principle of do no harm. And the American Psychological Association has decided that their people can participate in coercive interrogations whose aim is to cause prisoners to speak against their will. And the American Psychological Association has, joined the Justice Department under the Bush administration in, you know, deciding that the same standards that would apply to any interrogator should apply to a psychologist. And that's different than other health professionals. The other health professionals see themselves first as a health professional. The American Psychological Association has created a new category of operational psychologists and have basically joined with the military in, you know, saying that clinical psychologists can be military combatants whose aim is to debilitate the enemy, get information, and use people as if we're at war with them to undermine their mental and physical state if it helps the war effort. The story is that I have brought a ethics case against John Lesso, Major John Lesso, who was one of the health professionals at Guantanamo on the team that created the torture protocols that were used on two detainees very specifically, and in general, just about all the detainees. Some aspects of it were used on all the detainees. He's a clinical psychologist licensed in the state of New York. Unfortunately, the Board of Professional Discipline simply refused to investigate. And so we brought a case in New York State Supreme Court to have the court order the Office of Professional Discipline to open an investigation. And my argument was that a clinical psychologist who uses his psychological expertise, who's hired as a clinical psychologist for the client, which was the military, and is hired to do harm to individuals, is violating the ethical principles of New York psychology, the code that we are all beholden to, in such a way that he should be investigated and his license should be taken away from him if it turns out that, based on the investigation, that this allegation is true.
That was psychologist Stephen Reisner. Find more information on Reisner's torture case against Major John Lesso on our website at btlonline.org. After almost a year in office, the Obama administration's Attorney General Eric Holder announced in November 2009 that the president had decided to try 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other accused co-conspirators in civilian court in New York City. Over the ensuing months, initial political support for the decision eroded, and a firestorm of criticism soon erupted with fear about such a trial in New York becoming a magnet for new terrorist attacks and concern about the enormous expense that would be incurred for security to protect the city during the trial. More than a year of White House silence on the course of the 9/11 trials was broken on April 4th, when Attorney General Holder announced that the Justice Department was abandoning the New York City 9/11 trial and would instead try the accused suspects at the Pentagon's Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba before a military commission. Holder blamed Congress for interfering with the administration's trial plans by voting to prohibit the use of funds to transfer defendants from Guantanamo Bay to the United States. But critics assert that President Obama was too quick in deserting his initial campaign promise to reverse the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policies by succumbing to vocal opposition in Congress and in the media. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Attorney Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who blames President Obama for not standing up for the rule of law in trying 9/11 detainees in civilian courts and his failure to close the Guantanamo prison.
Well, the first thing for listeners to understand is a military commission is not a courts-martial. It's a special kind of tribunal that was set up by President Bush on November 13th, 2001, actually, shortly after 9/11. And it's only been used five times since then. Three of them were guilty convictions. And I consider it to be a kangaroo court. So I don't want people to mistake it with regular military justice. It's really a really washed-out version of a regular federal court proceeding and even of a court-martial proceeding. So here's the situation. You have these military commissions set up. People have been criticizing them forever, really, since November 13th, 2001, they were set up. What do we need them for? You can try these people in regular federal courts. And in fact, over the last 10 years, or almost 10 years since 9/11, they've tried some 400 people have been convicted or tried and convicted of terrorism, and 200 or so of a very important major one. So the federal courts can do it. So then they've captured the five guys they allege are the key conspiracy planners behind a number of terrorist acts, but particularly 9/11, the World Trade Center, as well as the Pentagon. And they've been holding them, and while they're holding them, of course, they tortured them. They tortured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the one probably most people have heard of, 183 times he was waterboarded. And so they've tortured him. The guys, some of them have confessed, et cetera, et cetera. On November 9th of last year, they said that they would try them in federal court in Manhattan, which is actually where I live. And everybody, at least civil liberties people, thought that was an incredibly positive, strong decision, and that was the right thing to do, treat them as criminals, give them a trial that's going to be respected by the rest of the world, that's going to comport with our regular system of justice, that's not going to allow evidence from torture, that's not going to allow hearsay, that's not going to have hand-picked juries that are all military people, that's not going to have a hand-picked judge, et cetera, et cetera. Then, after that was announced, then there was a whole big squall that went on. Mayor Bloomberg, Senator Schumer, and others started complaining, oh, the security is too much, it'll make us a target, it's too much money, all this kind of stuff. Then the administration, in what I would say is the real chickening, put them on hold for a while they were thinking about what to do with the five, to try them in a federal court or to try them by a military commission. And that's where it sat for, really, until a few days ago, when Holder announced that we're not going to try them in federal court, we're going to take them to Guantanamo, where they're there now, and we're going to try them in front of one of these military commissions. It did seem that he was sincere that he wanted these things tried in a federal court. There was even an indictment that had been issued for the trial in the federal court. It came out publicly. It has now been dismissed because they are not going to be tried in the federal court. And Holder said he had lawyers who were making their careers on this. They'd been spending years on the evidence. There was plenty of evidence outside of torture to convict, in his view, the five people who were considered the key conspirators for 9/11.
Holder then said, Congress stopped us. Congress cut off the money for bringing them here for trial. We essentially couldn't do anything because Congress did that. Well, what happened here was not that Congress stopped the trials from happening in New York or in another federal court. That was stopped when Obama and the Obama administration had no backbone to face up to the criticisms they were hearing from Mayor Bloomberg and Schumer and maybe a bunch of members of Congress. Congress had no law passed prohibiting the trials here when Obama and Holder decided to shelve the trials and hold them. And that took, they were sitting there for 6 months or a year or more since the announcement on November 9th. It was actually 2009, so it's over a year, almost a year and a half. What the Obama administration did is by failing to act, by failing to say we're going to go ahead with the trials that they'd done years of work on, they allowed the Congress to also get into the sort of not in my backyard sort of no alleged terrorists coming into New York or into the United States, and they passed a law saying no money could be spent to do that. It's total crocodile tears in a way. I mean, not completely by Holder, because maybe Holder wasn't making the call here, maybe the political people around Obama, maybe obviously Obama himself. To point to Congress and blame Congress is just disingenuous. And it's unfortunately, it's the way I would characterize the Obama administration, that every time there's a whiff of controversy, or a whiff that they'll be seen by somebody as weak on national security, what did Obama do? He pulled back, he said, we're going to think about this, and put him on a shelf.
Michael, what is the motivation, do you think, for the Obama administration to cave in here to pressure from Congress and public opinion?
What you have here is the kind of hysteria that you get around, whether it was anti-communism or, you know, anti-anarchism, or now it's hysteria around terrorism. And the Obama administration had a chance to lead, and it didn't. The reason why we're sitting here over 2 years after Obama promised to close Guantanamo, they perceived the political cost was not worth it to close down something that in their own views and in many other people's views actually causes more terrorism having Guantanamo open. But they just forgot about what the Constitution and liberty meant.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Find more information about the Obama administration's position on the 9/11 trials on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.